Good morning. Today is Tuesday, April the 6th. Joining us this morning, I don't know, where are you from?
I'm actually from the High Sierras. And yes, I know, isn't that crazy?
Dan Sparrow from St. Bernard / Sacred Heart.
How's that? St. Bernard Sacred Heart's definitely where I'm from.
Yeah. One's a church, one's a school.
And the church as well.
Yeah, I know. We have to, you hit the road trip every once in a while. All right, are you ready for our question this morning?
I am. What is it?
This is we're trying to find out. Oh, why are so many cows named Bossy?
I don't even. Well, Bessie, maybe?
No, B-O-S-S-Y.
I didn't even know there were. That was a cow name. I'm totally new.
Ah, apparently the person who first used this name around 1843 knew Latin, because it's believed that the name Bossy comes from the Latin word B-O-S, boss.
Boss.
Meaning boss. Cow or ox. So cows are named Bossy for the same reason that lions are often named Leo.
So Latin even gets and
permeates
it.
In even permeates out in the field farm.
Everything.
Yes. That's got to be. Have you ever read the Bible in Latin?
You know, I certainly use the Latin. I use the Vulgate, would be the translation that we would call the Latin Bible, and I use it usually before I get a homily ready, when I want to take a look at how it was written by or how it was translated originally, and give me the kind of. You know, I also will pull out different versions. So you'll have different versions of the Bible, and you'll also pull out the Latin. I will pull out the Greek on occasion. I'm not very good at Greek. But seeing all of the different ways that people have translated the original kind of helps me to get a better sense of what's really being said.
Well, that's one thing I think a lot of folks, whether they're Catholic or whatever, mostly Christian faith, the translations, the versions. King James, okay, people lost their lives because of the King James version of the Bible. Do you see nuances or do you see significant differences?
It depends on the translations. Most modern translations are really just excellent. I mean, it is hard to find a modern translation that's not trying to do something silly like,
you spin it.
Yeah, spin it in some way. But most modern translations are absolutely fantastic. And, the scholarship behind them, whether they be, whether that be run primarily by Protestants or Catholics or Orthodox or whoever's doing it, they're just doing an incredible job.
And consistently pretty
very
close.
Consistent. Well, I mean, to some degree, you're always dealing with translation. The way you say something and the way I say something are always going to be different. And each translation certainly has its own way of putting things. But each one of them is I haven't found a modern translation that isn't faithful.
Now, you said that you kind of used the Greek translation as a reference.
I do.
And that's as close to the real deal.
Well, that is the real deal.
As somebody can get because of the oral tradition prior to that.
Yeah, Koine Greek is definitely, that's the oldest stuff we got.
Are you able to understand?
Not a word. Actually, that's not right. I can understand a word. So what I'll do, usually when I'm looking at the Greek translation, because Greek, well, it really is Greek to me.
Yeah.
And but you know what I can do is I can look at that one word. And I like, for example, we'll be reading through, and one word I think obviously I'm misunderstanding what it means. I can really delve into that one word, and I'll open that word up, and I'll see what that word meant in the original Koine.
Like with context?
And then suddenly I have context for the whole thing. And that. So it's not so much with I'm much easier with the Latin, but with the Greek, it's more about really coming in and understanding what it exactly is being said.
So how do you get that sense? Do you read like one sentence and then
I'll read one sentence and I'll come down to one word. When I'm working with Latin, I can work in the sentences. I can see the whole sentence and I can kind of underlay what's going on. But with the Greek, I literally have a program that I click the word and it tells me what the word means. This is the modern age. We've brought the Bible into the digital, I'm afraid.
Oh, that's funny.
I would not have time to do that for every week for homilies if I didn't have those kind of tools.
Now, the oral tradition is something that, some folks understand and are comfortable with, and other folks kind of say, if we can't say the red, red rose and go around the circle with 15 people and come back with red, red rose.
I get this all the time. This this idea of telephone, the game of telephone when you were a kid.
Sure.
This is not oral tradition. That is not what oral tradition is at all. If we want to understand the oral tradition, we'd be much better to understand the Pledge of Allegiance. You see, when everybody says something together, if anybody screws up, everybody notices. You see, the oral tradition back in the day before the printing press was without question the most solid way of transferring information through the ages. There is absolutely nothing to match it. Because, frankly, the written word, when every single copy had to be handwritten, it was so easy to introduce error and realize that the people who could write were not as educated as the common person now. So the mistakes were, there wasn't commonalities in spelling. There was no such thing as grammar yet. There wasn't a such thing as punctuation yet. Like, the things that we take for granted as part of writing didn't exist. And so the oral tradition, this idea that we would all hold some piece of text in common, where we would all say it together, that was actually one of the best ways of transferring information through the ages that ever was.
So kind of like singing a song.
Very much like singing a song. One person screws up, everybody notices and corrects
them. That's why I'm not allowed to sing, by the way.
Well, that might
it's not the words, it's the quality.
It might be a quality issue. Yeah.
A little quality control knocks me out every time.
But you probably get the words right, and that's what the oral tradition was designed to protect, to defend.
Was to continue with that.
Mm-hmm. That's why we have the Iliad after all these years. Word for word.
I was thinking, Odyssey and Iliad, mm-hmm. depending on which side you like better.
Yep. They're both pretty good.
Yeah. Are you Greek or Roman? Okay, fine. KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:19.
Listen to 980 AM for the best music, ABBA, Neil Diamond, Barbra Streisand, Billy Joel, and the Fifth Dimension. The all-time best are heard every day, all day long on 980 AM. We are easy radio, easy on your ears and easy on your mind. This is memory-making music, and you'll love the memories you create. Tune in and hear the best music, easy radio, 980 AM.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:24. We're back talking shop this morning with Dance Farrell. Dance, the concept of the oral tradition and then rendering it to writing.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I think that a lot of us have either explored or tried to explore or have questions about is historical context.
Yeah, yeah.
We were talking a little bit about it during the break. Were the pyramids in Egypt built then?
Yes,
at the time
definitely.
Of Christ.
They were
obviously
old.
They were. Okay, and what was going on there? Well, okay, well, some of the stuff in Rome.
And well, you know, actually, you mentioning Rome is incredible because Rome is what changed it. This one of the questions I often get is, why did Jesus come when he came? And this particular period in Roman history was unlike any other because we had the Pax Romana.
Right.
We had the Roman peace. For the first time, don't get me wrong, there's always been trade. People have always been, wheeling and dealing with each other. Excuse me. But the Pax Romana gave this unbridled freedom of movement to where people could actually leave Jerusalem and travel all around the known world at the time. And this total freedom of ability to move, the freedom of ideas, don't get me wrong, persecution was a real problem, but at the same time...
Yeah, that whole crucifix thing was kind of a downer.
This was the first time anything like this could have ever happened. Like, this is the first moment in history when this could have happened. So the context of the history in the spreading of the gospel is paramount. Any other time period in history, it would have been locked down to an area. it would have been locked down to a single nation. But with Rome really, at this point in time, having control over the entire known world, it was able to move with a speed and with a fullness that it couldn't have done in any other generation. Oh gosh, probably up into the current age.
Yeah, I wouldn't think Genghis Khan, if he hadn't been of the faith, he probably would have forced it.
Well, and they didn't have to.
Exactly.
But there's also, you had this other part. You had this because of this freedom of movement, the Jewish people had moved throughout all throughout the world, and so you had these small communities of Jewish people living in Rome, living in Athens, living in Corinth, living all over the place, and this actually was perfect because they had already familiarized those areas with this idea of monotheism. In fact, you had all
these
people.
That was a significant shift.
Yeah. And so you had all these people who would really love to become Jewish, but they couldn't or wouldn't because of the Jewish law, namely circumcision. Right? So they didn't want to go through that process.
Let's say yes, that was a significant deterrent.
That's a significant deterrent. So they even had a name for these people. They called them the God-fearers. So when you read in the scripture, you read about the God-fearing people. Like Paul's coming into a town and saying, you Jews and you God-fearing people, he's meaning people who believe the Jewish faith but aren't a member of the faith. And so when they realize that the Messiah has come, they latch onto that with just this absolute veracity. So you have these almost these pre-built communities. So you got the Pax Romana. You got these pre-built Jewish communities all around the world ready to receive it. Just like it's like just been, it's like the most fertile soil you could possibly ask for. This is why God came then, because God created the perfect moment for that, and this moment is the seminal one in all of history. As of course we even relate our time around this moment,
right? Yeah,
you know.
So as you look at some of the historical discoveries that occur, you know, whether or not the Ark is really up on the hill in Tibet, you kind of go, well, okay, could that be? Maybe it was. Maybe it's not. How do you connect the dots and still feel comfortable with all the various elements that are there?
Well, you got a couple things. You know, when we're talking about, you know, modern archaeology has done more to prove the kind of story that the stories that we have are faithful than anything else. So a good example of that would be the Dead Sea Scrolls. Right.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Those,
oh man. Well, I mean, they really, we have, don't get me wrong, Dead Sea Scrolls are not gospel writings, but a few of them are, and they've shown that we've actually been very faithful to keeping those up. But, you know, so modern archaeology has a lot to offer us. I mean, you got to think, you know, before they found Troy, people thought that was a myth, you know, and it was, archaeology's changed that from being mythology into being, you know, an increasing legend of a certain place. You can go there and see it, and you can walk the halls. And that's an incredible thing. And the same thing's true when it comes to our faith. We look at the world, we're going to see that anything that we are saying that is true is going to be ratified. That's just the nature of things. And we're going to find always that, you know, things were a little bit different than we expected, but that's okay.
Well, we have our interpretations, as you were indicating.
There's interpretive issues, but, you know, more often than not, there's just nothing to fear from archaeology or any kind of historical outlook, as long as that historical outlook is being done honestly.
The chalice.
Mm-hmm. You mean like the Holy Grail?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, there's, what, three of them that kind of positioned, that kind of are the front runners?
There are a few.
Yeah.
And I honestly am not sure. You know, I don't know a lot about which one might have been the cup that was actually at the Last Supper.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's...
But it's a beautiful thing to think of, isn't it?
Well, and the reverence associated with it, whether it's the real one or not, to me is pretty neat.
Far more interesting than those cups would be the Shroud of Turin. Now, the Shroud of Turin, we were able to actually look at the Shroud of Turin this last weekend. They kept it on display for all of the internet to see. That's something historically interesting.
Yeah, there's some well, worthy of further discussion when we come back. It's 8:30.
Hey, community. Times are rough right now. Retail shops may be closing, but the bulk flower market is still open and moving fast. We here at Bayer can help turn your flower harvest into cash today. Call Bayer Extraction House at 707-693-2222. That's 707-693-2222. Don't miss out. It is time to sell. Bayer Extraction House, your flower selling powerhouse.
Good morning, KINS News and Information Time. It's 8:35. We're back talking shop this morning with Dan Farrell, deacon at St. Bernard's and Sacred Heart churches here in Eureka. Dance, why Vatican? Where did that come from?
I mean, that's a great question.
When you think about holy sites for a lot of Christians, and whether it's from the Catholic faith or one of the, I'm going to use a word that probably torques splinter. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody kind of came through the Mother Church. Why the Vatican as holy, and then Rome as holy, and then the Holy Land as holy? Why three areas?
You know, it's actually very strange. Like, why wouldn't it be Jerusalem? Because that's where Jesus died, right? That's where the Lord. That's
or Rome
or, well, you, Rome is the Vatican.
Yeah,
that's the same.
Well, okay,
because they're the Vatican is Vatican City's in
yeah,
Rome.
Yeah, it's part of yeah,
and it's so it's and why Rome instead of Jerusalem? And it all comes down to the fledgling church. Realize that Rome was the center of the world at the time, right? So. To some degree, all paths really do lead to Rome. And the paths of two particular people led to Rome. And these two particular people were so important to the fledgling church that they symbolized both the authority and the theological consistency of the church, of this fledgling way of people that were worshiping this new Messiah. And these two persons were Peter and Paul. Peter and Paul. We often think of the Pope as being the successor of Peter, and that's absolutely true, but it's not entirely. It's not the whole story. He's the successor of both Peter and Paul, and both of them died in Rome. And so since that's where they finished, that's where their seats were held. So it's kind of an interesting story. I can't remember which of the bishops or cardinals it was, but he was there for one of the papal elections, and he was looking out across the way from the Vatican, from the doors of the Vatican, and he could see the, you know, the old Circus Maximus, and he could see all the other Roman stuff, and he just had this grin, and somebody asked him, "Why were you smiling?" He says, "Well, I was looking out upon all those things, and I couldn't help but think that all of those things that were such great powers have gone and faded. And yet the church still stands." The church is still there, that the rock has not moved. When I say rock, I'm referring, of course, to Peter, right? And that, so really it's all about, it's not so much about the place as much as it is about Peter and Paul, that this is where their faith ended. And that's the rock that we stand on, is their confession of faith.
Which of the biblically historical mm-hmm. sites do you see as the most important?
I would say the synagogue in Capernaum. And the reason I'd say that is because if you walk along, don't get me wrong, the Sea of Galilee is beautiful. And there's no question that, you know, I would love to see the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Oh, my gosh. But something about the place where Jesus stood, we know the exact spot he must have been standing for him to have said the words, "These things have been fulfilled in your sight." When he reads from the prophet Isaiah, you know that he's standing right where they keep the book, and you can look at that spot and say, "I know that my Lord stood right there and proclaimed to the world that he had come." To me, that's the spot I would love to see. I would love to just be near that place.
Now, you mentioned the Church of the Holy Sepulchre.
Oh yes,
more myth than reality.
You know, I
more
doubt
reality
it. Actually,
than myth. What do you think?
It's hard to say. The reason we use the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the reason we chose that place, has to do with Saint Helena, who was Constantine's mother, and she found, she when she went back to the Holy Land, she rediscovered all of the
places. Started collecting everything and identifying things.
And that was needed to be done because really those things would have been lost if she hadn't done it. We still had it in the collective memory of where these things happened. So she went to Jerusalem and says, hey, where did this happen? And everybody goes, well, it happened over there. You know, like there was still memory of that. So chances are probably exactly right. Probably true. There's no reason to think it isn't. However, can we be 100% certain about that? Not in the same way we can be with Capernaum.
Well, when you think of the tomb, most of us have this image of a cave out in a field and a rock rolling up, not something dug in the way that has.
It's true. And if you look, if you've ever seen pictures of the Church of the Holy Spirit, it's like a church in a church. There's like
there's three churches.
They like build them around. Boom. Yeah. It's like those Russian eggs, you know?
Right. Yeah, nesting, I think,
It's kind of cool. But these, there's no question that if it's the best bet we got is definitely the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Where it is certainly the most likely place that those events could have happened. Pretty much almost every place in the Holy Land, it's probably right. Are we absolutely certain? No. But does it really matter? In one sense, we like to have that we like to know it's the real truth.
Some certainty. Yeah.
But if you stand in the Holy Land, you're breathing his air. And so, I mean, it's almost like if it's this room or if it's that room, does it really make a difference? Because this is where it happened. And if you're standing there in the moment and in the place, the effect that's going to have on your heart and soul is going to be the same regardless.
KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:41.
The Redwood Region Economic Development Commission wants you to know that local economic development agencies, business resource organizations, financial institutions, and jurisdictions are working together to provide resources for the COVID-19 pandemic. For more information, go to northcoastsbdc.org or call the OES Business Hotline at 268-2527. 268-2527.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:46. We're back talking shop this morning with Dan Sferrell. Dan, as you consider some of the different elements, a lot of folks who are not that familiar with the Catholic faith, and I would presume other Christian denominations also, are either unknowing or a little hesitant about relics.
Oh, yeah, relics.
You know, when we think about relics, a lot of times we think of rummage sales, we think of secondhand stores. We think of grandma's tea set.
Yep.
It has a different connotation when it comes to the religious relics. What is it, and where did that stuff come from?
Absolutely, that's a very interesting question. You know, relics are something that we all actually already do and just don't think about it. For example, when my grandmother died, God rest her soul, I wanted some things from her house. I wanted some things to remember her by. Like she was an artist, so there was some of her art that I wanted and some things that were precious because of their memory to me. And in the same way, the church has kept mementos of the most important things that have happened in history. Now, there are two different kinds of relics. There are relics that are actually the person, and then there are relics that are related to the person. So, for example, it wouldn't be unseemly if my wife were to die for me to take a lock of her hair and to keep it with me always as a remembrance of just how much I love her and waiting to see her when we go to heaven. There'd be nothing odd about that. And that's exactly what the church has done when it comes to the people, the most holy people that have lived. You know, we recognize saints as being these people who've lived the Christian life in an exemplary fashion. And we know that they're not gone from this. They're part of our family. And of course, we remember our family. We remember them by putting a statue up to just remember how great they were. And we remember them by keeping some part of their person close to us. And those relics are a precious reminder that these are real people like you and me and that if they can live the faith out, then so can I. That's that kind of real touchstone is so important. But then we have the other kinds of relics, which are relics that are really focused on objects that were really important to people. An obvious one here would be the cross of Jesus, right? Jesus was died on a cross made of wood. Is a real thing.
The wood,
actual wood. I mean, would it be? There's something incredible about holding a piece of that cross.
Now, there is discussion that those some of that might still be around.
Oh, there certainly is. I mean, well, again, we were talking earlier about the holy sites and how St. Helena found, well, it was St. Helena that found the true cross. And so we have plenty of almost all of our relics are dated back to that cross that she found. Now, the only real question
is, has any of the cross made it to America?
Absolutely.
Okay, so absolutely. It's not just in Europe and in the Middle East.
What happened is, well, a big chunk of the cross fell off when they were transporting it back to, I don't remember where they were transporting it to, but it fell off, and it broke because it was old and rotten. And they actually pounded it into a meal and put it into they put it into unfired clay and made like coins out of it so that people could hold a piece of the cross from these little coins. You'll find them, they're stamped, and that's, they were literally about as far back as you go. The rest, a lot of it was, the cross was slowly taken apart piece by piece and made into small relics that were given to many churches around the world. They're all over the place. There's tons of them because it was a big piece of wood. So, and they were handled very preciously. And then we had a large piece that was destroyed after I don't remember the exact problem, but a huge piece of it was destroyed I can't remember exactly. But regardless, you know, most of the relics we have date back to that cross from St. Helena. So holding a piece of that, you're like, wait a minute, this is, could very well be the very piece of wood that our Lord was nailed to. That's the incredible heirloom. And even if it's not, even if for some reason that cross of St. Helena was not the cross, does it change anything? Like, this reminds me every time I look at it of what my Lord and Savior did for me, how he carried the weight of my sin.
What it represents versus
what it represents is far more important than whether or not it's accurate.
This is totally off the wall.
Yeah.
Cathedrals in the Middle Ages, mm-hmm. Gargoyles.
Gargoyles.
What is a gargoyle, and why is it to scare things away?
Oh, I'm afraid you found the limit of my knowledge. I have to admit don't know a lot about gargoyles.
They're so prevalent.
Well, and there's so much going on with medieval construction, especially when you start looking at the cathedrals. I mean, you got labyrinths built into the floorings. You've got, I wouldn't venture to say with any surety, because I don't know.
Cathedrals for me would be something that's very interesting. I'm hoping that Notre Dame will be able to come back a little bit.
Oh, see,
and that
Notre
that
Dame,
spurs. Right. I mean, can you imagine going on a vacation of seeing cathedrals in Europe?
You know, that would
with somebody who knows what they're talking about.
It would be the joy.
Wouldn't that be cool?
Joy after joy after joy.
Yeah.
You know, I've only been to Europe once, and it was actually before the Lord brought me home. And so I didn't realize what I was seeing. I would
it's
love
like
to go
walking
back again.
Past the Louvre and looking at the line going, too long.
Exactly. That was me.
I'll see you next time.
As a dumb punk kid, not knowing what I was doing. But gargoyles, you know, I couldn't tell you. I'm sure something to do with, you know, fending off evil or those kinds of things.
Now you got something to do get to school, huh?
I had to do with my research.
All righty, bud. Thanks for coming by. See everybody tomorrow.